Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. Governments love the language of consultation. They hold meetings, they invite submissions, they talk to organizations, they publish frameworks. They say they have listened. But farmers know the difference between being consulted and being heard. And that difference matters, because agriculture is not some abstract policy file. It's land, weather, animals, equipment, markets, debt, regulation, succession, research, transportation, trade, and most importantly, trust. But it's also food security. And the ability of a country to feed itself begins with the people who produce the food being taken seriously, listened to, and engaged on a substantive level. So today on the Future Herd, we're joined by John Barlow, Member of Parliament for Foothills, Alberta, and a longtime voice and champion of agricultural issues in Ottawa. And this conversation really is about the politics of standing up for farmers. It's about why Canadian agriculture has enormous potential and why that potential is so often slowed down by poor consultation, regulatory distance, political neglect, and a public conversation that understands food far better than it understands farming. John makes a rather blunt case. Governments need to actually listen before they regulate. Not perform listening, not check the consultation box, actually listen to producers, ranchers, commodity groups, young farmers, and the people closest to the consequences of the decisions being made. Because food security starts long before food reaches the grocery store. It starts at the farm gate. And that's something I think a lot of Canadians forget, but that John, to his credit, really focuses on in terms of his job as an elected representative and as the shadow minister for agriculture in our government. I was really excited to have this conversation, and I hope you enjoy it nearly half as much as I did. John, welcome to the Future Herd.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, it is a pleasure for me. I love talking policy on this podcast, so to actually speak with a member of parliament really hits home. And of course, I do want to talk about your constituency as well in terms of understanding some of the concerns that the ranchers and farmers that you represent. But I love to start off the show with a really abstract question that I ask all of our guests, which is, what does the future mean to you?
Well, in the future of agriculture, I think the future to me would be us able to take advantage of the opportunities that are right in front of us. But in many of those cases, we just can't get out of our own way. So it's, you know, it's that gold medal is right there within your grasp. But in many ways, you just have to remove a couple of hurdles to take advantage and grab that gold. And I think we can do it. We just need to work together to achieve that.
Right on, right on. And that very much aligns with my worldview, which is it's the obstacles and hurdles that in life we need to be focusing on, not so much the problems we might find in the present in terms of the future. Now, the other second question I love to ask is kind of the origin story or lore. And I kind of imagine in a parallel universe, you're a big hotshot in the sports media world. And I say this because it's remarkable how many of the guests that I've had on the podcast either have a communications background or a media background, that leadership today really speaks to the ability to communicate. So without asking you what led to Parliament Hill, I'll frame that as,
yeah,
would you still be working in the media today if the industry was able to provide the kind of excitement and opportunities that it used to?
Yeah, you know, I love the career. I really enjoyed it. You get to meet people. Every day's a bit different, very similar to politics, I guess. But yeah, had I remained on my path, I would have maybe been still in the newspaper business in Alberta. But if I go back, you know, 40 years, I would be a reporter for Sports Illustrated. That's probably where the initial goal was. But things get sidetracked a little bit.
The greatest time of my youth was the 5 years I had a Sports Illustrated subscription, so I could totally relate. Now, of course, you
Sports Illustrated gave us a discount if you're involved in media way back in the day, so that was even better.
Right on, right on. Now, of course, you do currently have what to me is a dream job, and I say this only because I'm a bit of a policy nerd, and I love kind of watching the front lines of how politics is made. So my question for you here is, how did you gravitate towards agriculture? You know, partly in terms of you having the kind of shadow minister portfolio, but I suspect you could have picked a range of portfolio issues or policy issues to focus on that might have still been relevant to your constituency. Mm-hmm. Why agriculture?
Well, I would love to give you this this very poetic explanation of how this happened, but it doesn't really happen that way. You know, after every election, you give the leadership your list of things that you're interested in, and then they make that decision on where you go. And, you know, I had to, in all seriousness, had to fight for agriculture for a few years. You know, I started in Aboriginal Affairs and Natural Resources, which was great. But I didn't get the role in agriculture until I think 2018. And then I've kind of been on that ever since. So it took me a few years to get there. But I will give Andrew Scheer, our former leader, all the credit. This was something he thought I would excel at, put me in this role, and I've savored it ever since.
And to your point, you have, in my view, done a fantastic job of elevating a policy area that I think you and I recognize as being valuable, but it does tend to be ignored or neglected by the kind of larger political discourse. So why don't we start with that? What do you think needs to happen, either on Parliament Hill or across the agricultural sector, so that we get more of the respect, more of the attention that we deserve, given that food is kind of the basis of everything else?
You know, I think agriculture and food production as a whole needs to be elevated to a top priority in Ottawa. And then hopefully the mainstream media would actually pay attention to what's going on in this industry. Just say, I can't tell you the number of times I have had phone calls or emails from people in the media, the large media outlets, who will call and say, hey, I've just been given the agriculture beat. I don't really know much about it. Would you sit down and kind of walk me through it? I always say yes. Anybody who's interested in this industry, I want you as a partner. I want to help you in any way I can. Those conversations happen and then never to be heard from again. I think they just move on to other things. So it's kind of frustrating that you, like, I know there's a kind of a simmering interest underneath the surface, but I think there's a lot of that squirrel mentality, you know, something else comes up and they move on to the next cool thing. And I really thought we had an opportunity with COVID where for the first time in my lifetime, I would go to the grocery store and there was empty shelves. Canadians were questioning or were open to education on where their food comes from, you know, who does it, where it's produced. And I think we really missed that opportunity to grab onto that and take that as a chance to educate Canadians, elevate this to a big issue. I think that opportunity is right in front of us again, with food affordability, trade issues. If we do not take advantage of this, you know, don't waste a good crisis. If we don't take advantage of this and really reach out to Canadians, educate them about where their food comes from, how we do it, why we do it, I think this is yet again a failure on leadership, not only politically, but even with communications in the mainstream media as well.
You know, why don't you elaborate on that a bit? And in no small part, because I saw yesterday you put out a post on X that really linked food security to the larger kind of research capacity that, especially in rural communities, plays an important part in terms of the larger agricultural sector and the rural economy. Which, to your point about the journalists who come to get the free crash course from you and then ghost you afterwards, there does seem to be a disconnect in our media in terms of, to your point, not only helping people understand where their food comes from, but understanding the infrastructure that the sector requires to thrive, to prosper. I'd love for you to kind of unpack that.
Yeah, I think the closure of the seven research stations and experimental farms is a perfect example, a microcosm of what we're dealing with here, where if you can't get the little things right, if you can't get the very beginning, you know, we talked about reaching for that gold medal. If you stumble out of the starting gates, you're probably not going to win that gold medal. And by turning our backs on research and innovation, I think you're getting the fundamental beginning of this race wrong. Where every single expert that we had said this is the consequences of these closures is potentially catastrophic. But you also have a government that says, the prime minister says, a country cannot feed itself, has very little options. So how do you say that on the global stage? And then one of your first actions as a government when it comes to a decision around agriculture is to close seven essential research centers. Closures that will only save, and I say only, you know, in the bigger scheme of things, about $200 million over the next 10 years. When you have a $75 billion deficit, I can tell you I can find that $200 million in a multitude of different places. This is a decision not based on budgeting, but a decision based on values. And this message to me is agriculture and agri-food production is not a priority with this government. And that's what my video was really stressing is if we really care about food safety, we really care about food security, food affordability, then we should be augmenting and ensuring these research centers have the resources that they need, not stripping it away. And I just, the message that this sends to agriculture is concerning for sure.
And this gets to one of the other things I was really excited to talk to you about, which is part of the privilege of your role is you get to hear from farmers. You get to hear from sectoral leaders, mm-hmm. you know, partly because you put in the effort, but partly because they want to talk to you. So it's kind of a two-parter. I'm curious, on the one hand, what you're hearing from sectoral leaders who are trying to do their best, either in this case to look at the loss of these cuts and the impact that has, let alone advocate for other policies that, you know, champion and reinforce the sector. But you also represent individual farmers and ranchers who I have to assume you're also in touch with, and is all another kind of source of intelligence of what's happening out there on the ground. So I'd love to hear what you are hearing to get a greater sense of how the kind of larger food security or just the larger crisis around the costs of farming, you know, what you're hearing in terms of the general concerns, as well as the kind of actions that we should be looking at and entertaining.
Yeah, certainly we take a two-pronged approach to these issues when we are trying to resolve them or find potential solutions. Certainly, the agriculture stakeholders have, you know, very talented people in Ottawa as part of their lobby efforts. We listen to them. We meet with them on a regular basis just to get the pulse of some of the concerns that they are having. But I think it's absolutely critical for us to to just reassure ourselves or to just quantify the actual priorities by talking to farmers, ranchers, producers, processors on the ground. Are these truly the priorities that they see? Are they feeling the effects of whatever this issue be? Or are they focused on something entirely different? And I think it's absolutely critical that as elected officials that we keep our finger on the pulse of people who have their fingers literally in the dirt. So I'm very blessed to be representing Foothills in Southern Alberta. So I have a wide variety of agriculture folks in my riding, and I'm truly reach out to them on a regular basis. I have some of the most talented agriculture people in the world that live in Southern Alberta. So I'm very lucky that way. But I spend, you know, as much as my wife will wonder where I am sometimes, I spend a lot of time on the road in other parts of Canada as well. Agriculture, as you will know, Jesse, there's a lot of the same issues permeate throughout the country, but agriculture is different in every part of that country as well. So I think it's really important that we spend as much time as we can meeting with those people at their farms, at their ranches, you know, listening to them firsthand so they feel they have a voice. But also then we can really assess what their priorities are. And I think that's absolutely essential.
And, you know, indulge me with a few anecdotes. And I say this only because I am burdened with the being in Ontario and suffering from the insularity that Ontario fosters. And one of the things I love about this podcast is I'm learning about all the amazing agricultural innovation and practices across the country. So I'd love to hear some anecdotes, both, you know, from your riding, but to your point, you get the privilege of seeing some incredible farming operations across the country that, to your other point, our media kind of ignores, and we don't celebrate, and we don't elevate at the stage that recognizes the amazing work that the sector is doing. So help me out here. Give me a couple of anecdotes that have really motivated some of the work that you do.
Yeah, I think I'll give you a couple of examples that actually happened recently. And one would be the CFIA traceability rules around ranching. If you remember, that came out about 6 or 8 months ago now. You know, we raised this as an issue in 2023. And, you know, no one seemed to be really concerned except for some of the agriculture societies, rodeo groups. But then when it was released, the ranchers in my riding just went apoplectic. They were like, what is this? And it really showed me the importance of speaking to those people on the ground, because there was clearly a disconnect between ranchers on the ground and what the Canadian Cattle Association, Alberta Beef, Saskatchewan Beef were assuming was the concern here in Ottawa, that there was a real disconnect. So having those conversations with those ranchers on the ground right across Western Canada, bringing that, you know, kind of connecting CCA and those, like, it took some work, but CCA has come, changed their position on these traceability rules and now oppose them. And that just shows you that you can't always assume that the right hand knows what the left hand wants and vice versa. I guess on the outreach side, you know, I've had an opportunity to wander in a cranberry bog, which I never thought I'd ever have done. I've been on a potato harvester. I've been down in my hands and knees harvesting celery. You know, you come from Western Canada and you kind of think, well, agriculture is tens of thousands of acres of grains and oil seeds and ranching. But you have farmers who are toiling just as hard on 100 acres in a very unique, very cool agriculture commodity that's on a much, let's say, a smaller land stamp, but it's just as lucrative and just as important to them as your 10,000 acres in Saskatchewan. So just to compare how things are done, but the one common thread is how much these farmers take care of their soil, water management, input costs. So when we kind of joke that when they talk about regenerative or sustainable agriculture, you know, we take a drink, because this is nothing new. This is what farmers have been doing for generations and improving upon that every opportunity they have, because they have to. If they don't take care of their soil, their water, and their livestock, then they don't have a livelihood. So that's why I think it's important that elected officials get out to the field, see what they're doing. It's an eye-opening experience, and you will have a much better appreciation that farmers aren't out there destroying land or, you know, tossing chemicals willy-nilly. They are trying to be as efficient and sustainable as they possibly can, and that's not new. And unfortunately, I think there's such a vast gap between what Canadians think happens and what actually happens. And what Canadians think happens, I think, permeates too much to the elected officials, where they are just so disconnected to what actually happens at the farm gate that we have to find a way to bridge that gap.
Right on. And that was one of those great answers where you kind of spawned four questions simultaneously, and I'm going to try to sort them so we can get through all of that. With the key, which I want to flag to come back to, and this has been a recurring thread on the guests we've had in this podcast, which is the need to align the leadership that farmers bring on their farms, in their communities, with the regulatory environment that many of them see as hostile. And how do we get those aligned so that leadership amongst the farmers is there? But you said something at the start, which I've been wanting to talk about on this podcast for a while. I've raised the question of the traceability issue with a few guests, and they didn't know about it. You're the first guest who, again, because it's your riding, you understood the issue. I kind of came to it because I'm a social media guy. I learn about farming. I learn about agriculture through social media. So I saw that grassroots phenomena take off, and I kind of had the front row seats with, you know, people like Lance Nielsen, who is one of the social media users, you know, really organizing around it. And it struck me how it was a real moment for me in terms of not just trust and authority within the sector, but a new power that farmers and ranchers are kind of coming into. So I would love to hear your thoughts on how you kind of helped mediate that and help bring people together. And to ask a pointed political question, do you think the CFIA recognized it for the crisis it is, or do they just think this is social media nonsense, which I don't think it is? I think, to your point, there are legitimate sentiments amongst farmers and ranchers that people can't ignore. I'd love for you to help educate us as to what you saw on the ground there.
Well, I think the essence of it was a failure of, whether that's the Canadian Food Inspection Agency or the Canadian Cattle Inspection Agency, a failure to communicate what the proposals were all along the line. Every government will say they're consulting, but clearly they're not. Because I think what really happened, Jesse, as you said, you saw the explosion on social media, is this ranchers just felt that this was thrust upon them. They had no idea this was coming. Whereas, you know, the bureaucrats in the offices in Ottawa say, "Well, what do you mean? We talked to Canadian Cattle Association. We talked to them." But that wasn't, for whatever reason, that wasn't trickling down to the rancher on the ground. So whether this was a malicious change in regulations, I'm not sure that was the case. I think what really the essence of this was is ranchers and cattlemen did not feel they had a role in building or developing these new traceability standards. I think if this happened at the beginning and they helped them walk them through it and say, yes, this is possible, and no, this is an overlap, I think this might have been in a very different position. And as you said, with social media, word spreads fast. And the anger with this spread incredibly quickly, like a prairie fire. And I think there's a lot of distrust amongst agriculture as a whole and CFIA, and rightfully so. CFIA has become a toxic culture, which is no longer an ally of agriculture, is an adversary. It needs a massive reassessment, rebuild, culture change. So all of that distrust with CFIA certainly planted the seed here. And now we're waiting to see if CFIA actually takes the feedback from producers and goes back to the drawing table and comes back with something that's more workable and includes ranchers in that process. Or if they've just kind of gone into hibernation for a few months, they will come back with the same thing and press forward. I think that's something we're going to see in the next few weeks.
And to your point, I think the legitimate sentiment amongst ranchers, amongst farmers, is not going to go away if they feel that they're not listened to. So, you know, the follow-up question, based on what you were saying before, and this is where on the future herd we get to imagine the future. We get to imagine that the current obstacles aren't in place. How could we create? What would a regulatory environment that was led by farmers, that they viewed that regulatory environment as positive, as enabling, rather than their legitimate perception that it hinders them, that it's oppressive? What would that look like? How do we achieve that? And I say this because I'm getting near consensus amongst the sector that the status quo is not working, that there needs to be a rethink about the regulatory environment. Let's try to get ahead of the curve. What could that look like? How could we create an environment where farmers felt they were being supported rather than being held back?
Well, I think the first thing right off the top, Jesse, is that, like I said, those producers feel like they're part of the process. And right now, there just seems to be a disconnect between the bureaucrats in Ottawa and what the folks are trying to do on the ground. And you have groups like the Canadian Cattle Association who are trying hard to bridge those gaps, but they're kind of at a loss as well. The government will say, "Oh, we're consulting with you. We've had meetings, but if you're not actually listening to what we're telling you, then that's not really consultation. That's you ticking a box." So I think that's first off, is you have to genuinely include the producers as part of that discussion and that process. Are producers always going to be happy with what comes out in the end? Probably not. But at least they can say to their colleagues and their friends at the coffee time in the morning that, "Hey, guys, this is what's happening. This is what we proposed. This is what we expect to happen." At least there's no surprises. The second thing is CFIA has to stop being almost anti-agriculture, let's say, and be a partner and work on ensuring that decisions that they make have a lens of economic impact and food security. Compliance cannot be the cudgel that they do on every single thing. CFIA was, in essence, to be a defender of Canadian agriculture on the global stage. But that role has reversed, where it is now almost embarrassed of Canadian agriculture, despite the standards that we have set. And CFIA is imposing standards on Canadian producers that it does not impose on imports into Canada from countries around the world, that is making Canadian agriculture much less competitive, much higher costs, and much higher frustration. Some of the ridiculous decisions that CFIA has made, Jesse, I'm sure you've heard it, you just have to shake your head and going, there are big problems for us to focus on. Let's focus on solving those big problems. And these tiny little micro issues that you are slamming down on producers and processors and entrepreneurs is just making this industry untenable. And until we get that culture within CFIA and PMRA, for that matter, adjusted to be working with agriculture, I think it's going to be very difficult for us to grab hold of those opportunities that are in front of us.
Well, and how much does this tie back to something you said earlier, which is, I will rephrase as a kind of urban-rural divide, where a lot of people who live in cities don't understand where their food comes from, don't understand the agricultural sector, don't understand the environmental stewardship that every farmer practices. And then you sort of acknowledge, quite rightly, that permeates up into urban members of parliament who then have a different, arguably an inaccurate view of how food is made. That then influences the regulators. How can we address that? How can that be either reversed or challenged so that, as I keep trying to emphasize, the people with the knowledge and expertise lead the process, i.e. the farmers and producers, rather than people who are multiple levels disconnected from what is actually happening and their understanding therein? I can't ask all politicians this, but someone with a media background, I suspect, understands the nuance or challenges that come with this.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. That is a big part of the challenge that we have, is that misunderstanding amongst urban Canadians, even Calgary and Edmonton. We're not just talking about Eastern Canada or Central Canada here, about where their food comes from. And, if I could solve that, I certainly would. We have programs like Agriculture in the Classroom, 4-H, programs the Liberals have cut funding to, by the way, that are trying to do some of that outreach. But as most Western Canadians and rural Canadians, we either grew up on the farm or very close to it. You're a grandfather or aunts and uncles or some. We spent time on the farm. We understood it. But now so many Canadians are generations away from really having any exposure to what happens in agriculture. And as a result of that, you have that disconnect. But I think what's happening right now, and not only in Canada, but I would say Europe is a very similar example, is you have governments and elected officials listening to the very vocal minority who have agendas. For lack of a better term, these are eco-activists who see everything about agriculture as wrong. They don't understand it. They don't try to understand it. And they are very loud, very organized, and very effective because they target their urban elected officials and drive that message home. And that's where you see a lot of these policies that, you know, you kind of throw your hands up and go, like, where are you coming up with this? This is completely inaccurate. The second thing is, as I would say, I kind of describe CFIA and PMRA as the children of divorced parents. They're kind of in agriculture. They're kind of in health. Neither minister really wants to take account for them or take responsibility for them. So they know they can go to one or the other, kind of get the answer they want, or neither one will deal with it. You know, for example, I'll go to the agriculture minister and I'll say, you know what, strychnine's a good example. We were trying to get emergency use for strychnine in West Alberta, Saskatchewan. You go to the agriculture minister, he goes, well, you need to go see the health minister. PMRA's in the health. I'll go see the health minister. She said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Can you go talk to the agriculture minister? So neither one of them is taking responsibility for an issue, and neither one of their agencies are either. So I think you have to take CFIA, put it back in agriculture, have it operated and run by people who understand this industry. Of course, it's going to be the regulator. There's going to be rules there. But at least it's going to be operated by people who understand the industry, will work with people, will know who to reach out to when on certain issues. And then that you have this very strong minister that will hold them accountable, will push them to be that partner that agriculture is looking for. So I think that's a really important step, Jesse, is take CFIA, put it back in agriculture where it belongs, and restructure that agency to be a partner, not an adversary.
And I do want to come back to that in terms of imagining different portfolios or different structure of government to really empower the sector. But I think a really interesting question to ask before that would be, you know, what's your advice to sectoral leaders, both as an elected official, but also as a recovering media executive? How should sectoral leaders be doing the kind of tactics you just described, which is targeting the urban MPs, educating the urban MPs, you know, help expanding their literacy of not just the sector, but the needs of the sector? Because to your point, their opponents are doing it quite successfully. So what would your advice be, both on a strategy and tactics level, to sectoral leaders who clearly need to step up their game?
Well, I would say I would give them a couple of different pieces of advice, and they've heard this advice from me. I'll just say that they need to work together. There are hundreds of agriculture stakeholder groups in the country, almost too many, in my opinion. But they have to find those four or five top priorities that they all agree on. Put your resources together, focus on those few issues, and get out there and start communicating that. They are doing a much better job over the last number of years in terms of having having a platform on social media where they are getting out there having farmers talk about what they do. And you were seeing some really successful agriculture influencers who are trying their best to get that message out there. But as we all know, with algorithms, if you are not looking for that, you are not going to find it. So they have to find different resources, combine their talents and their resources. And like I said, just focus on a couple of different things at a time, whatever your top priority are, whether that's TV advertising, you know, really lobbying hard on mainstream media to talk about some of these issues. Ensure agriculture in the classroom has the resources it needs to expand that program. We need to start getting to kids at a very young age to explain to them what agriculture is. And unfortunately, those groups that we talked about on the opposite side of this are already in the classroom. Getting the teachers to show documentaries that show agriculture in a very poor light. We have to have the counter to that. And the answer always, Jesse, and I know you've heard this as well, is, hey, we're busy. We're in the field. We're planting. We're harvesting. We can't use that as an excuse. If we use that as an excuse, we will lose. We have to set priorities. And this is a priority, is educating consumers about where their food comes from. Because bad policy comes from bad information, and that's what's happening right now.
And let me dig deeper into something you said there, which tragically you are, I think, the first guest that we've had on the podcast who recognizes the power of social media, especially within the agricultural sector. And while this is certainly true amongst farmers, amongst people active in the sector, because social media is a hotbed of agricultural activity, innovation, just storytelling. But I find a lot of leaders have a disdainful view of social media. To them, it's just noise and the rabble. But you clearly acknowledge at the very least that it plays a role within the larger communications ecosystem. So I'd love for you to double down on why you think it is a key piece of the messaging strategy of making sure that we are impacting public opinion, let alone the people who have the power in public opinion, whether in the media or on Parliament Hill.
Well, it's simple. That's where people are going to get their information now. They aren't going to the mainstream media for the most part. The boomers and my generation certainly still rely on mainstream media, but those decision makers, the ones that we are coming up into the system, the ones that we need to influence, are going to social media. That's where they're getting their information. And agriculture is certainly tuned into that. And you are seeing some great work by some great people who are just filming what they're doing on the farm every day. You know, Potato Ty in BC is a great example of the success that he has had. You know, a farm girl in Ontario, I believe she's there. You know, incredible success some of these people are doing. And I'm hoping it takes time, but eventually their word will start to spread and people will start to share what they're doing. But it is an essential communications tool. And as I said at the beginning, we must use every tool at our disposal to reach as many people as we possibly can in whatever medium they are looking at. So we have to be on all of them, whether that's the National Post, CTV, or TikTok, that we need to be where viewers are.
Right on, right on. Now, I want to come back to something that mentioned earlier, and this is, again, the kind of question that I can only ask someone as advanced as you. You know, one of the threads I love to bring into the podcast is getting people to talk about policy, which we've already been doing. But I kind of want to indulge your position and expertise to talk about governance. Because maybe to your point of having, you know, agriculture treated as like the children of divorce or a neglected stepchild, how could we? If you had the control of the PMO, whether you were the prime minister or the prime minister's trusted deputy, how could we reorganize ministerial portfolios? How could we ensure that the agri-food sector as a kind of larger umbrella was accurately positioned to be the global player that it is, but I think everyone in the sector feels we could be even greater, we could be even more prosperous, we could rise to the challenge that the world kind of geopolitical turbulence is offering us. What would be the right configuration of government resources that would achieve that? Again, we get to do this on the Future Herd because we can, you know, blue sky this stuff. But I suspect you're in a position to answer this question the way other people might say, hey, it's above my pay grade.
Well, I think it's not a hard question. I think the fundamental answer is this is a values question. If the leader of the government, the prime minister, does not see agriculture as a priority, it will not be a priority. If you do not have a strong minister in charge of this portfolio who is going to be a defender at the cabinet table, agriculture will not be a priority. An example is the Prime Minister Carney has an economics committee as part of cabinet, an economic development committee. The agriculture minister is not a member of that committee. So already you are saying this, you are at the kids table. The agriculture minister should be one of the top cabinet positions in government. For the last 12 years, it has not. I would say we haven't had that person since Jerry Ritz, who I think all of us would agree was a very strong agriculture minister. But to me, Jesse, it's a values question. You don't need to restructure cabinet and government. You just need the prime minister who sees this as the pillar to our economic development as it is. And I agree with you 100%. Canada, it should be the envy of the world. We have what the world needs. We have sustainable, affordable, quality agricultural products. We have an abundance of natural resources. We should be the wealthiest country on the planet, period. But we do not see those two industries as critically important. And we continue to kind of push them back, hoping for better results elsewhere. And that's, you know, the rest of the world is laughing at us for what we've done to two of our key pillars when it comes to natural resources and agriculture. So this is not a where you need to tear it down. This is a values question. You need people in those positions who see agriculture as a critical pillar to our economy.
So let's roll that forward. What would be, you know, what would be the kind of policies if the values in place, if you were the minister or even the prime minister, what would be the kind of policy initiatives? What would be the kind of rallying points that to your point would allow us to actualize on our potential and be, if not the one of the wealthiest countries in the world?
Well, I think the first thing that a government should do, and this government has the opportunity to do it. We've talked about it. We did a pretty extensive study on this at Agriculture Committee our first job one when we came back after the last election was harmonization of regulations and red tape reduction. So the first thing this government could do that would send a very strong message to agriculture is harmonization of regulations. We actually have a private members bill on the table right now through my colleague, David Bexty. Basically what this does is any agricultural product, veterinary medicine, crop protection product that is being used in another country of which we as a trusted partner, if that product wants to be used in Canada, if it's used in two other trusted jurisdictions, the agriculture minister would have to give it provisional approval within 90 days to use that product here in Canada. So the CFIA and the PMRA are not redoing the science all from the beginning. You have to take their research. You can still review it parallel, but that product would be able to be used in Canada. That would send a very strong message to Canadian producers that you have a government that's on your side, a government that recognizes the obstacles that you are dealing with, where we are continuing to fall. I think we are something like 35 out of 50 countries. No, it's less than that. 35 out of 42 countries in the OECD in terms of regulatory burden on agriculture and falling. This would send a very strong message that we recognize this, we are going to fix this, and here's one way we can do it. The Liberal government's going to be coming out with a food security strategy in the next few weeks. We've kind of heard some rumors that it's on the way. Include some of these things in that strategy and send that message to producers that, yes, we are listening, we see the challenges you have, and we are going to act. But thus far, we haven't seen that. Another one that's coming up right now is the Mercosur trade deal with South American countries. Brazil and Argentina, Colombia is the main ones. Canadian agriculture has raised the alarm on this, that especially beef, pork, and poultry producers, that you're going to be opening Canadian market to products that don't meet our standards, do not meet our animal health regime, traceability. You could be opening us to foot and mouth disease, African swine fever, BSE. And yet the government is plowing ahead and is going to sign this agreement in a couple of weeks. So there's another example of agriculture just not being listened to. It's not that we're against free trade. Agriculture relies on free trade, but doesn't mean you have to have trade with everyone, especially if it's not reciprocal. Those countries allow about 1% of livestock imports into their countries. Meanwhile, 30% of domestic consumption of beef in Canada is imported. So we've already done our part. But you need to be selective on which partners you want to agree with. Instead of chasing new markets, why don't we look at the Canada-European Free Trade Agreement, CETA, which there are numerous non-tariff trade barriers that have been put in place blocking Canadian agriculture commodities. Let's focus on fixing the ones that we already have. Open those markets to our full capabilities before chasing others that are going to be a problem.
Well, and I appreciate you brought up the Mercosur deal, only because I have seen, to your point, a lot of concern, widespread concern in the sector. And it kind of raises a very political question. Are you concerned that in the government's attempt to try to address affordability, that their ignorance or disconnect with the sector might mean that said affordability comes at the sector's expense, i.e. if you're importing cheap food that undercuts the sector's ability to produce food, that's clearly not a net positive. And so I'll add to that a second question to your very insightful point. Not all trade is equal. And we're in a world in which trade agreements are increasingly becoming almost bilateral, although to your point, even the multilateral have their complications. How do we address that stuff, especially given the kind of the ignorance, for lack of a better word, that we've acknowledged already that exists amongst much of the urban political class? Like, if they think they're doing the right thing in terms of affordability, but actually sabotaging our own sector, how do we prevent that? How do we communicate that effectively, given the nuance it requires and the kind of soundbite nature of our media world?
Well, I think first off, Jesse, it's very hypocritical of the Liberal government to be plowing ahead with this trade agreement. On one hand, they're saying we need to buy Canadian. Buy Canadian. We need to be self-sufficient. Let's support Canadian products, Canadian industry. On the other hand, you are going to sign a free trade agreement, which, as you said, will undermine one of the pillars of our economy, which is our agriculture industry. This is certainly focused on beef, pork, and poultry right now, but there are other commodities that certainly could be challenged. The United States has seen the error of this with Brazil flooding its market with corn and sugar. The United States was looking at this as well until American ranchers basically lit their hair on fire, saying if you start bringing in a bunch of cheap Argentinian beef, this will destroy our industry. So even President Trump backed off and he said, okay, I listen, we're not going to go down this road. We are doing the opposite. Despite the concerns that are being raised by our industry, we're going ahead. So you can't, on one hand, tell consumers, when you go to the grocery store, look for that Canadian flag, buy that Canadian product, and on the other hand, start bringing in a bunch of low-quality international imports that are going to undermine our own Canadian products. So that is the problem. And I'm not sure if the Liberals are actually focused on affordability here. I think this is two things for the Liberals. A, this is going to give them a great media soundbite. They say, hey, look at us. We've signed another trade deal with the fifth largest trading bloc in the world. And it gives them another chance to poke Donald Trump in the eye. They love nothing more than making sure that Trump is the boogeyman. And anytime they can kind of stick it to him a little bit. Because the United States, Jesse, as you may know, has flagged this agreement as a problem. They do not want to see that cheap, low-quality product coming into the United States through the back door through Canada. So once again, our most important trading partner, the trading partner that our agriculture industry is fully integrated with, has told us, hey, we see this as a big problem. You want to keep trading with us in the way that we do agriculturally? You better not be signing this agreement. But they're going to go ahead and do it anyway because it's going to look good in the media for about 2 days. Meanwhile, Canadian producers are going to be suffering through this. As we've already seen with the UK, for example, UK beef imports into Canada were up almost 700%. Beef exports into the UK are at zero, same as pork. So the Liberal government is not defending Canadian agriculture producers on the global market. They are capitulating. And again, to your point, the fundamental issue here is those urban voters or those decision makers really don't see it. They don't understand the consequences of it. They are so far away from it. Those of us who represent rural parts of the country, we are the ones who are there at the forefront defending this industry as wholeheartedly as we possibly can. But I think that's really the two issues that are at stake here is this is going to be a great media soundbite for the Carney Liberals, despite the devastating consequences that it could have on Canadian producers. And it's another opportunity then for them to kind of stick it to Donald Trump, despite the warning the United States has given Canada should they sign this agreement.
I also think it's significant to your point that it was a large number of American ranchers who really sounded the alarm on the impact that this particular trade deal would have. And credit to the Trump administration that they heard that and responded. it strikes me that we have a problem here in Canada, that our ranchers don't have the same political weight, at least in Ottawa. They certainly do in Alberta. How do we get Canadian rural voices, whether agricultural or otherwise, to have greater influence and power in our public conversation? I think part of that, as we've sort of alluded to, is a media problem. But I suspect you're not the only member of parliament who really feels that their constituents are not getting a fair shake. How do we address that? And is that an opportunity for the agricultural sector to help champion because of the benefit they would have in rural voices having more influence in ultimately in policy?
Well, I think when they do focus their message, they are effective. And, you know, we talked about the traceability rules. You know, CFIA did pause that. We have had success in them pausing some things in the past. The P2 plastics ban is another one where industry came together. Our Bill 234 to eliminate the consumer carbon tax on farm fuels. Every agriculture group came together, and it was very successful. I think on these existential threats, the different commodity groups need to find common ground and work together. And when they do, they have a very powerful and effective voice. But unfortunately, government can be very effective in divide and conquer as well. The Liberals are experts at it. They will go to the different groups and they will not come to a consensus, and they say, hey, you know, we consulted, you guys could come to an agreement, so we're going to do X instead of Y. The commodity groups on these times of real threats need to come together, and I know they do, and they need to be loud and they need to be aggressive sometimes, because the other groups, as you said, we said at the beginning, they are very effective and very aggressive. I know the Canadian Cattle Association is going to be working very hard with its partners, trying to gain allies on the Mercosur deal. We have been working very closely with them, and they've been really effective. And the second thing is they agriculture groups are not always just meeting with rural MPs. They're meeting with everyone from all the different parties. And I think that's a really smart strategy, is they need to make sure that everyone hears what the consequences and the impacts are. And they bring solutions, which I think is also really important, that they aren't just coming here and complaining. They are coming with real, tangible solutions to their problems, which I think is critically important as well. And we have a really good group on the Agriculture Committee. I think all of us represent rural ridings that will be impacted by some of these decisions. So that's helpful if the minister and cabinet will listen to the recommendations that we bring forward from the Agriculture Committee.
On. And I am conscious that we're just about out of time, because I'm kind of tempted to spend another hour just talking about the tactics of how to get everyone on the same page, because that is a recurring desire amongst the sector, sometimes easy, sometimes not. But the second last question I always throw to the guest is there anything we haven't talked about that you think is really important to mention, especially in the context of championing Canada's agricultural sector?
Well, I don't know if there's anything that we haven't talked about. I think the big message I would want for people to get from this is, you know, talk to your neighbors, talk to your family who live in urban centers, or maybe no one understands. You know, the people who are going to be listening to this podcast, Jesse, obviously understand what we're talking about for the most part. But I would really encourage them to try and share their message in any opportunity that they have. Don't be scared to have a little bit of a heated discussion with someone. Stand up for what we believe in, and we believe in the tradition, the values, the innovation of Canadian agriculture and food production. And I always highlight that, Jesse, is talk about it as a in the frame of food production. I don't think people understand what agriculture is, but they certainly understand the food on their table. And these farmers and processors, ranchers, are producing the food that's on your table. And I think that is an important distinction to make.
Right on. And it's similar to advice I give to city people, which is make friends with a farmer, which now, thanks to social media, right, yes, is actually pretty easy. You know, the last question
if you ask a farmer to come and visit, they will be happy to show you around.
100%. And you will experience things that you will never experience in a city. Now, the last question I always leave to guests is kind of the shout out. It's really, who are the leaders who inspire you? Who are the people that you think the rest of us should be tuning into or following? You dropped a few names earlier in terms of social media influences, but who are the folks that you look up to that you think deserve more attention?
Oh, man, that's really going to be a challenge because, like I said, you know, in my riding, I've got some of the incredible agriculture leaders, you know, in the world, not just Canada. So, you know, I started a bit of an agriculture roundtable of representatives from my riding. And the first time that we sat down with everybody, I kind of looked around the room and I'm like, oh my gosh, I am totally blessed to be representing these people. And I could learn so much from them. You know, Kim McConnell, from the founder of AdFarm, for example, Ted Menzies, former president of CropLife, my predecessor, you know, Roy Newman, a very prominent grain farmer in Blackie. You know, Sherry Copperthorne Barnes, now the vice president of the Calgary Stampede, a rancher in the western part of my riding. You know, these are incredible people who do incredible things. And, you know, first and foremost, they're farmers and ranchers, but they have taken on incredible leadership roles around the world. But, you know, I have those types of people that I reach out to right across Canada, and I'm very blessed to call them friends and call them mentors in one way or another. But I think most importantly, I rely on them for good information and honest conversations. What I love about a farmer is they tell you the God's honest truth. They are not going to sugarcoat it. If you are full of beans, they are going to tell you you're full of beans. And I think that's really beneficial to me as an elected official and hopefully a policymaker, a decision maker, that I'm getting the unvarnished truth, and they don't tell you just what they think you want to hear.
And, you know, to be honest, John, the proof has been in this podcast episode, because I am 100% allergic to bullshit and you brought none. This was rare for a politician, perhaps, but not for someone who, to your point, is held accountable by farmers and ranchers.
Well, I Jesse, now that I know I could said bullshit, I would have said it a long time ago, but I never consider myself a politician. And I think I represent my riding. I don't think I've ever changed. And my friends and neighbors would certainly give me an earful if they thought my head was getting too big. So I appreciate that, maybe this is a bit of a different tone, but I can assure you this is the tone that I have in all my conversations. I don't think it helps us at all if we're just filling each other full of bullshit. We need to be honest with one another, and that's how hopefully those changes that we've talked about today can actually come to fruition. And I am really optimistic. I have to say, I always try and finish with this, that, you know, although we've talked about some real big concerns, I am truly optimistic of the future of Canadian agriculture because of the potential that we have, because of the people who are involved in that industry, some of those names we threw out here today. But the young people who are getting involved in agriculture, that entrepreneurial spirit, that openness to new ideas, so exciting. The one thing that we have to do is we have to make sure those young people see Canadian agriculture and food production as a viable career choice with a real future to grow and thrive. And I think if we can achieve that, the potential for Canadian agriculture is really unmatched.
Right on. Fantastic. Thank you, John. What I really enjoyed about this conversation was how quickly it moved past slogans. Food security can sound like something that belongs in a strategy document. Agricultural innovation can sound like something that belongs in a funding announcement. And consultation can sound like something that already happened because somebody held a meeting. But today's episode with John really brought those words back down to earth and speaks to the kind of integrity and commitment that we expect of our elected officials, and to which John, I think to his credit, lives up to. You know, to the rancher trying to understand a new rule, to the farmer waiting for a product approval, to the producer wondering whether Ottawa understands the cost of delay, to the next generation deciding whether agriculture still looks like a future worth building. In this context, I think John's argument's pretty direct. Canadian agriculture does not lack ambition. It does not lack talent. It does not lack people willing to work, adapt, take risks, and feed this country. No, what it needs is to be taken seriously by folks in cities, by people who make decisions. And that means listening before regulating. It means treating producers as partners in food security rather than obstacles to policy. It means recognizing that the knowledge closest to the land is not a special interest. Quite the opposite, it's a form of national intelligence. And maybe most of all, it means agriculture has to keep finding its voice. In Ottawa, in the media, online, and in the everyday conversations where Canadians learn where their food comes from and who's actually producing it. Because the future of food will not be built by people talking about farmers or around farmers. It'll be built by people willing to listen. And that's really what we seek to do here in the Future Herd. It's not just here from people like John, but from people like yourself. So if there's a subject, a topic, an issue that you'd like us to dig deeper into, send us an email. Or better yet, check out our website where you can find that email address, as well as all the episodes and knowledge and briefs that we put out to help you understand our agri-food sector so it can truly be the best in the world. I'm Jesse Hirsch. We'll see you soon here on The Future.